help you remember it. Strike the twos and strike the threes, the sieve of Eratosthenes, when the multiples sublime, the numbers that are left are prime. That's the way it works, he went on. Look at the list of numbers. Ignore the one. There's a sort of gentleman's agreement among number theorists to pretend that the one doesn't belong there and shouldn't be called a prime, because just about every theorem about number theory goes all wonky if it includes the one. So the first number on the list is two. Now you go along the list and strike out every even number, that is, every number divisible by two after the two itself, the four, six, eight, and so on. He did that. So now the smallest number left, after the original two and the one that we're pretending never existed, is the three. So we strike out the nine and every later number left on the board that is divisible by three. So that leaves us with the two, the three, the five, the seven, and the 11, and so on. And now you have generated a list of the first prime numbers. Now we've only gone up to 20 because my hand gets tired when I write long lists, but the sieve works for any number of digits. If you were to write down the first 90,000 numbers or so, I mean everything from 1 to around 90,000, your last surviving number would be the 1,000th prime, and you would have written every prime before that as well. Now, Ranjit glanced at the wall clock, as he had seen so many of his own teachers do. Because these are three-hour sessions, I'm declaring a 10-minute intermission now. Stretch your legs, use the facilities, chat with your neighbors, whatever you like, but please be back in your seats at 1:30 when we'll begin to take up the real business of the seminar. He didn't wait to see them disperse, but ducked quickly into the private door that led to faculty offices down the hall. He used his own facilities. Pee whenever you get the chance, as, according to an urban legend, a queen of England had once counseled her subjects, and quickly called home. "How's it going?" Myra demanded. "I don't know," he said honestly. "They've been quiet so far, but a fair number of them have put up their hands when I've asked questions." He considered for a moment. "I think you could say that I'm cautiously optimistic." "Well," his wife said, "I'm not. Not cautious about it, I mean. I think you're going to knock them dead, and when you come home we'll celebrate." They were all in their seats when he returned to the podium, a minute before the big hand hit the six. A good sign, Ranjit thought hopefully, and plunged right in. "How many prime numbers are there?" he asked, without preface. This time the hands were slow in going up, but nearly all managed it. Ranjit pointed to a young girl in the first row. She stood and said, "I think there are an infinite number of prime numbers, sir." But when Ranjit asked why she thought that, she hung her head and sat down again, without answering. One of the other students, male and older than the rest, called out, "It's been proved." "Indeed it has," Ranjit agreed. "If you make a list of prime numbers, no matter how many are on the list or how big the biggest of them is, there will always be other primes that aren't on the list. Specifically, let's make believe that we're all pretty dumb about numbers, and so we think that maybe the last term in that list, 19, is the biggest prime number that ever could be. So we make a list of all the primes smaller than 19, that is, 2 through 17 above, and we multiply them all together. 2 times 3 times 5, etc. We can do this because, although we're pretty dumb, we have a pretty good calculator." Ranjit allowed time for a few giggles to survive, then went on. "So we've done the multiplication and obtained a product. We then add 1 to it, leaving us with a number we will call n. Now, what do we know about n? We know that it might turn out to be a prime itself, because, by definition, if you divide by any of those numbers, you have 1 left over as a remainder. And if it happens to be a composite number, it can't have any factor that is on that list, for the same reason. So we've proved that no matter how many primes you put in a list, there are always primes larger still that aren't on the list, and thus the number of primes is infinite." He paused, looking the students over. "Any of you happen to know who gave us that proof?" No hands were raised, but around the classroom names were called out. "Gauss? Euler? Lobachevsky?" And from the back row, Your old pal Firma?
Ranjit gave them a grin. No, not Firma, and not any of the others you mentioned. That proof goes way back, almost as far as Eratosthenes, but not quite. The man's name was Euclid, and he did it somewhere around 300 B.C. He held up an amiably cautionary hand. Now let me show you something else. Look at the list of prime numbers. Notice how often there are two prime numbers that are consecutive odd ones. These are called prime pairs. Anyone care to guess how many prime pairs there are? There was a rustle of motion, but otherwise silence, until some brave student called out, "An infinity!" "Exactly," Ranjit said. "There is an infinite number of prime pairs. And for your homework assignment, you can find a proof of that." And so at dinner that night, Ranjit was more spontaneously cheerful than Myra had seen him in some time. He informed the family, "They made jokes with me. It's going to work." "Of course it is," his wife said. "I had no doubt. Neither did Tashi." And indeed, little Natasha, now allowed to join the grown-ups at dinner, seemed to be listening attentively from her high chair when the butler came in. "Yes, Vijay," Mevrouw said, looking up. "You look worried. Is there a difficulty below stairs?" He shook his head. "Not below stairs, madam. There was something on the news that I thought you might want to know about, though. There's been another of those silent thunder attacks in South America." This time, it wasn't a single nation that had been driven back to the pre-electronic age. This time, there were two of them. Nowhere throughout the countries of Venezuela and Colombia did a telephone now ring, or a light go on when a switch was pressed, or a television display its picture. So the rest of that meal was completed with little additional conversation about Ranjit's seminar, or even about the skillful way Natasha was manipulating her spoon. The room's own screens, never used during meals because Mevrouw thought that was barbarous, were full on now. As with Korea, there were few scenes from inside either of the freshly subjugated countries, because the local facilities were all now blacked out. What was on the screens was a few sketchy displays of Pax Per Fidem cargo planes, the kind with short takeoff and landing capabilities so they could dodge around the frozen aircraft on the runways, bringing in the same sort of troops and equipment that had poured over the border into North Korea. Mostly what was on the screens was talking heads, saying much the same things they had said about Korea, and a lot of stock footage to display the events that had brought on the current disaster. The 21st century had not been good to either of the two countries. In Venezuela, it was politics. In Colombia, drugs. In both countries, there had been violence and frequent governmental crises, capped by the decision of the former narcotics lords to take over some of their neighbors' now far more profitable oil business. Pax Per Fidem took on North Korea first because he didn't have a real friend in the world, Ranjit told his wife. This time they took on two countries at once because they had different friends. The U.S. has been propping Colombia up since the 90s, and Venezuela was close to both Russia and China. "But there's a lot less killing going on now," Mevrouw said thoughtfully. "I can't feel unhappy about that." Myra sighed. "But do you think we'll be better off when the whole world is run by Oceania, Eurasia, and East Asia?" she asked. Chapter 30 Big News. When the seminar was over, no student had managed to produce a rigorous proof of the infinitude of twin primes, but then Ranjit hadn't expected one would. Neither had Dr. Davudboy. At their post-seminar conference, though, he was visibly happier than before. He flourished the student comment slips at Ranjit with a grin. "Listen to these. I had the feeling I wasn't just learning how to do mathematics. I was learning what doing mathematics was all about." "Good stuff. Dr. Subramanian doesn't treat us like children, more like we were new members of his research team." "Can I take his next seminar, too?" "And what would you say to..." He glanced again at the slip. "This young lady, Ramia Salgado." Ranjit looked uncomfortable. "I know who she is. She was very active in the seminar. Maybe if we needed another warm body to fill the class out? Oh, said Dr. Davoudboy, I don't think you need to worry about that. You do want to do another, don't you? Have you thought of a subject? Maybe something like the Riemann conjecture? There are proofs of that, Ranjit reminded him. Some people don't think they're satisfactory. Anyway, there was a proof of Fermat, too, Wiles's, and that didn't keep you from finding a better one. Ranjit considered, then shook his head. I'm afraid Riemann is too complicated for anybody but a professional mathematician to care about. How are you going to get the average college student to care about what way the zeros in the Riemann zeta function are distributed? There are better ones around. Euler's reworking of the Goldbach conjecture, for instance. That's pure gold. All positive even integers greater than 4 can be expressed as the sum of 2 primes. 6 is 3 plus 3, 8 is 5 plus 3, 10 is 5 plus 5, or 7 plus 3, if you like that better. Anybody can understand that. Only nobody has ever proved it. Yet. Davoudboy considered for one of the smaller fractions of a second, then nodded. Go for it, Ranjit. I might even like to audit one of those sessions myself. As the years flowed from that point in time onward, Ranjit began to realize that he truly loved teaching. Each semester brought a new flock of eager students, and of course he had his monthly reviews of the ladder to tend to, and Natasha was growing from a young, promising girl to a slightly older girl of significant promise. If anyone in the world shared Myra's concerns about the 3 Pax per Fidem sponsors dividing the world among them, there was little sign of it. Silent Thunder was as gentle a conquistador in South America as it had been on the Korean Peninsula. The casualty list was not much longer. The problems of feeding and caring for the suddenly technology-less populations were as quickly met. The outside world observed and discussed and seemed to think that Pax per Fidem had done a reasonably good thing. Part of the reason why the affair had gone so well, Ranjit knew, was that the advance planning had been meticulous. Weeks before the attack, the 2 surviving old American aircraft carriers had been loaded up with everything needed for the job, the goods supplied mostly by Russia and China. Fully prepared, they were deployed to the Gulf of Mexico on training missions, the routine Department of Defense announcement said, and in fact ready to start supplying emergency help almost before the echoes of Silent Thunder's nuclear blasts had died away. Even Myra had to admit that the effects had not been bad. They were dawdling over a leisurely Sunday breakfast in the garden, just the 3 of them. Ranjit was checking some lecture possibilities on one screen, Myra idly following the news on another, while Natasha, who was nearing her 12th birthday, practiced her backstroke in the pool. Then Myra looked up, sighing. "It looks like they're coming to an agreement," she told her husband. "Kenya and Egypt and the other countries that depend on the Nile River water." He gave her a comfortable smile. "I thought they would," he said. He had, in fact, all but guaranteed they would, at a time no more than 6 months past, when the 2 principals had mobilized their not inconsiderable military might and sent the armies to glare at each other. But then the UN Security Council had favored them with one of its strongly worded warnings. "I guess they take the Security Council more seriously now, with Silent Thunder always looming," Myra ruminated. Ranjit demonstrated what an intelligent husband he was by omitting any "I told you so." All he said was, "I'm glad they're working it out. Listen, what would you think if I said my next seminar would be on the Kollatz conjecture?" Myra looked puzzled. "I don't think I've ever heard of that one." "Probably not," Ranjit agreed. "Most people haven't. Old Lothar Kollatz never got the publicity he was entitled to. Here, I'll show you." He turned his screen so they could both see it. "Take any number, something under 3 digits. It works with really big ones just as well, but it takes too long. Got the number?" Myra essayed, "Well, how about, say, 8? "Good one. Now, divide it by 2, and keep on dividing by 2 until you can't get a whole number answer anymore." Obediently, Myra said, 8, 4, 2, 1. "Is that what you mean?" "That is exactly what I mean. Now wait a minute while I put it on the screen." "All right. That is what we will call rule number one for Kolatz. When it's an even number, divide it by two and keep on doing that until you don't have an even number anymore. Now, take an odd number. Five?
Ranjit sighed. All right, we'll just do the easy ones.
So, now we apply rule number two. If the number is odd, you multiply it by three and add one.
15, 16, Myra supplied.
Good. Now you've got an even number again, so you go back to rule one. Let me put that on the screen. As Ranjit quickly typed 8, 4, 2, 1 next to his other numbers, Myra raised her eyebrows.
Huh, she said. They look the same.
Ranjit gave her a large smile.
That's the point. You take any number, even the largest number you can think of, and work on it with just those two rules. Divide by two if it's even, multiply by three and add one if it's odd, and you'll come down to one as a result every time. Even if the numbers you start with are pretty big. Wait, I'll show you.
He typed some programming instructions onto the screen and gave it the number 27 to start with. Alternating rules 1 and 2 as directed, the screen displayed 81, 82, 41, 123, 124, 62, 31, 93, 94, 47, 141, 142, 71, 213, 214, 107, until Ranjit shut it off.
See how the number keeps bouncing up and down? It's sort of pretty to watch, and sometimes the numbers get really large. There were some people at Carnegie Mellon who got it up to numbers with more than 50,000 digits. But in the long run, it always collapses to one.
Well, Myra said comfortably, sure it does. Why wouldn't it?
Ranjit gave her a hot look. We mathematicians don't deal in the intuitively obvious. We want proof. And back in 1937, old Kolatz made his conjecture, which is that that will happen to any number at all the way up to infinity. But it has never been proved.
Myra nodded absently. Sounds like a good possibility. Then, shading her eyes as she looked toward the pool and raising her voice, she said,
Better take a break, Tashi. You don't want to get overtired.
Ranjit was quick to meet his daughter with a towel, but he was looking at his wife. Finally, he said,
Myra, you sound a little bit distracted. Is anything wrong?
She gave him a fond look, and then a real laugh.
Wrong? Not at all, Ranj. It's just that, well, I haven't seen the doctor yet, but I'm pretty sure. I think I'm pregnant again.
Chapter 31 Skyhook Days. For Myra de Souza Subramanian, caring for her second infant was even more of a breeze than caring for her first. Her husband, for example, did not now come home depressed from a job he thought irrelevant. His students liked him, he liked his students, and Dr. Davudboy was unfailingly pleased. The outside world was easier to take now, too. Oh, a few nations could not seem to break the habit of making threatening noises at their neighbors. Hardly anyone was actually getting killed, though. And over Beatrix Vorhulst's protests, they had finally moved into their own little house. Little, only by comparison with the Vorhulst mansion, just steps from one of the island's beautiful broad beaches where the water was as warm and welcoming as ever. By the time they were settled in their new house, the world outside no longer seemed as threatening. Little Robert splashed in the shallowest part of the pool, while Natasha found deeper water to demonstrate her considerable, and Ranjit maintained clearly inherited, skill at swimming. Or any other way, when she wasn't taking sailing lessons from a neighbor who owned a little sunfish. What made being in their own home particularly pleasant was that Mevrouw Vorhulst had parted with her favorite cook and Natasha's favorite maid to save Myra the trouble of housework. Another way in which Myra's second pregnancy was unlike the first went by the name of Natasha. Well, more often it was Tashi. Tashi wasn't a problem. When she wasn't winning ribbons for swimming, only in children's events so far, but she was seen to watch adult races with narrowed eyes and obvious intentions. She was busy at being her mother's assistant, deputy, and sous-chef. Thus aided, Myra had a gratifying number of hours each day to spend catching up on what was going on in the field of artificial intelligence and autonomous prostheses. That was quite a lot. By the time Myra had begun to evaluate each muscle twinge in the hope that it might be the beginnings of labor, she was pretty nearly up to speed again. Of course, that wouldn't last. By the time the new baby was birthed, weaned, toilet-trained, and off to school, Myra would have slipped behind her cohort again. That was inevitable. Was Myra angry at this tyrannical law of childbearing? It was clearly unjust. It dictated that any woman who wanted a baby had to accept Mother Nature's inflexible decree that for a period of time the cognitive functions of her mind would have to take second place to mothering. It would have to be a fairly significant period, too. 10 years was the accepted minimum before a female AI nerd, or medical doctor, or politician, or, for that matter, pastry chef, could get back to her career. Obviously, that was unfair. But the world was chronically unfair in so many ways that Myra D'Souza Subramanian had no patience for wasting time in resentment. That was the unchangeable way the world was. What was the point in complaining? There would be a time when both her children were in college. Then she would be as free as any human could ever get. And then she would have 20, 30, maybe even 50 years of productive life in which to unravel the riddles of her chosen profession. Deferred gratification was the name of that game. You didn't have to like its rules to play by them. And one way or another, you might even win. Both Myra and Ranjit considered themselves big winners when Robert Ganesh Subramanian was born. His parents thought they had hit the jackpot with two fine offspring. Robert was a vociferously healthy newborn who gained weight and strength as rapidly as Ranjit and Myra could have hoped for. He tried to turn himself over in his crib even earlier than Natasha had, and was toilet-trained almost as early. All of their friends declared that he was the handsomest child they had ever seen, and they weren't really lying, either. Robert was the kind of infant for whose picture baby food manufacturers would have paid handsomely to put on their labels. Interestingly, if there was anyone who loved baby Robert more than his parents did, that person was little Natasha, who wasn't all that little anymore, and was already beginning to demonstrate a considerable aptitude for athletics, education, and getting her parents to do just about everything she might require of them. Which, in this case, was to let her take care of baby Robert. Well, not quite all of his care, not the part that involved situations that smelled really bad. But dressing Robert, pushing Robert around in his stroller, playing with Robert, Natasha demanded the privilege of taking care of those things, and after some early, worried hesitation, Myra gave her daughter what she asked. Actually, Natasha was good at the job. When Robert screamed or roared, it was Natasha who could usually fit words to his outcries. And when his mother took him away, Natasha had her own life to live, school or her daily swim sessions, or most likely combining her interests with her friends joining her at the pool, or Robert slumbering beside her as she studied English verbs or the history of India and its satellite nations. All this, of course, was a good thing for Myra. With Natasha relieving her of so much of the work of raising Robert, Myra was not falling behind as rapidly as she might have feared in AI nerding. And what was good for Myra was certainly good for Ranjit, for whom his wife was as dear and as unpredictably exciting as she had been on the day they were wed. All in all, things were going well for Ranjit Subramanian. One seminar per semester was all he needed to do, Dr. Davood Boy had decreed, but as long as he was going to do the one, they might as well make it a big one. So Ranjit's classroom had become the exact supersized theater in which he had thrilled to Joris Voorhoof's stories of the worlds of the solar system. Ranjit didn't have 20 students at a time anymore either. Now he had 100, which Dr. Davood Boy assured him entitled him to the luxury of a teaching assistant. That eager young woman, Ramia Salgado, now possessed of a master's degree of her own, who had so enriched his second seminar, and freedom to do his own research for the rest of each semester. Davood Boy intimated that that was so he could get a head start on whatever proof he was going to assign his next class. Or, Ranjit realized, it was a good time to do some of that exploration of his native country that he'd been intending to get around to ever since Myra had first chided him as over-parochial. That was a more attractive idea than it might have been some years earlier, for even tourist travel was looking more attractive in this post-Silent Thunder world. They could, for example, cruise the Nile River, as Myra had longed to do since she was 10. Both Egypt and Kenya had furloughed large fractions of their militaries, while the ecologists for all the countries involved worked out water-saving ways of containing their thirsts for Nile water. The Subramanians could have taken the children to London, or to Paris, or New York, or Rome, to get an idea of what a great city was like. They could have settled for Norwegian fjords, or Swiss mountains, or the jungles of Amazonia. They could indeed have gone almost anywhere. But what in fact happened was that while they were still studying travel brochures, they got a text from Joris Voorhoost. It said, "Mother tells me that you have some vacation time coming. I'll be down at the terminal for at least a week, starting the first of next month. Why don't you come see what we're doing these days?" "Actually," Myra said, "that would be fun." And Natasha said, "You bet." And even Robert, hanging on to Natasha's chair and listening to every word, bellowed something that Natasha explained was a yes. And so the family of four prepared for its first long trip together. It wasn't just Voorhoost's invitation that made Ranjit look forward to visiting the Skyhook terminal. There were actually two reasons. And the first was the advisory board that Voorhoost had talked him into joining a number of years ago. It had been as undemanding as Voorhoost had promised. No meetings to go to, not even any voting on any issues, because if there were any issues troublesome enough to require a decision, that decision was made for them by the real controllers of the enterprise, the governments of China, Russia, and the United States. Ranjit had, however, been the recipient of a monthly progress report. There, too, the heavy hand of the Big Three was felt, because most of each report's content was sternly secret, and even more of it was simply dismissed as what was cryptically called development. He had only been to the site a handful of times, and those visits had been quite cursory. Whether he would learn more by being at the scene, Ranjit could not say, but he was anxious to find out. The other reason was a surprise to Ranjit himself. The Subramanians didn't have a car of their own. Ranjit and Myra biked to most places, sometimes with Natasha riding happily in front of them and Robert strapped into a child's seat behind his father, and when they needed more in the way of transport, there were always cabs. But the university had promised the loan of a car for the trip, and Ranjit picked it up from the grinning Dr. Davudboy. "It's special for you," he said. "Pax per Fidem sent it. It's a new design from Transparent Korea. With all those geniuses who used to build weapons now free for new civilian ideas, they've got a lot of stuff." And when he'd explained what the perky little four-seater could do, it sent Ranjit back to Myra grinning with pleasure. "Get me a pitcher of water," he commanded as he pulled up at their house. Mystified, she obeyed. She was even more mystified when he ceremoniously opened the fuel tank and poured the water in, and when he then started the motor and listened pleasurably to its purr, she was totally baffled. He gave her the explanation Davudboy had given him. "Boron," he said. "It's called the Abu Hamed drive, after I don't know who, maybe the person who invented it. You know the element boron is so hungry for oxygen that it'll pull it right out of compounds like water. And when you take the oxygen out of the water molecule, what do you have left?" Myra frowned at him. "Hydrogen, but—" Grinning, he touched a finger to her lips. "But boron's terribly expensive, and burning a carbon fuel's so much cheaper that nobody ever bothered with it. But here it is. They've found out how to regenerate the boron so they can use it over and over. And so we're driving a car that not only is low emission, it doesn't emit anything at all." "But," Myra began again, this time he stopped his wife's lips with his own. "Get Natasha and Robert, will you?" he coaxed. "And our baggage? And let's see how this hydrogen burner works." Which turned out to be very well. They did have to stop twice to add water to the fuel tank, under the scandalized stares of the people running the filling stations they stopped at, but the little car performed as well as any fossil fuel burner. They were still 10 kilometers from the terminal when Robert emitted one of his heart-stopping shrieks. Myra jammed on the brakes, but it wasn't a sudden danger. It was simply an exciting sight, what Robert was waving at, as he said, "Spider!" and "Climb fast!" and "Many, many, many!" was the cable of the skyhook itself barely visible as something that glinted from the sun. But what it carried, once you knew what to look for, was visible enough. There were the cargo-carrying pods, one after another, marching up into the sky and disappearing into the first layer of clouds. "Huh," Ranjit said. "Looks like they've really got it going, doesn't it?" So they had. The road to the terminal was paired up with a railroad track, and as they were approaching, a train, 42 freight cars, Natasha counted excitedly, overtook them and disappeared into one of the terminal's giant sheds. There were guards at the car entrance, but they passed the Subramanian family with a friendly salute and a wave in the direction of the VIP parking lot, where they were met by a handsome Asian woman who introduced herself as Joris Vorholst's assistant. "Engineer Vorholst was looking forward to seeing you very much," she informed them, "but he didn't expect you until tomorrow. He's on his way, though. Would you like something to eat?" Ranjit opened his mouth to say what a good idea that was, but was overruled by his wife's faster response. "Not just yet. If we could just look around for a bit..." They could. They were warned to stay out of the loading sheds, and of course to beware of the trucks and tractors that were lugging around unidentifiable bits and pieces of no doubt excitingly interesting objects. Ranjit contemplated all the activity with benign incomprehension. "I'd give a lot to know what some of these things are," he informed his family in general. Young Natasha pursed her lips. "Well," she said, "that lumpy package there is the thruster for an ion rocket. I think the bale next to it is carbon nanotubes in sheet form. I'd say probably part of a solar sail." Ranjit gazed at his daughter, open-mouthed. "What makes you so sure?" he demanded. She grinned at him. "While you were talking to that lady, Robert and I poked around and I read the bills of lading. I think they're building spaceships up there." "And," called a familiar